Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Katie Schaefer. Today we're talking all about The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, which is a novella, I guess. I guess it's technically a novel because it's over 200 pages. I'm not really sure where the distinction lies between a novella and a novel. So it's definitely just one of his shorter works in general, which was a nice little breather for me in between some of his more intense reads. But Katie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to talk about this one. And for those who wonder, a novella is up to 39,999 words. Anything 40,000 or over is considered a novel.
So it has nothing to do with page count necessarily.
Nope, because page count can change. So it's always word count that they base that stuff on.
Well, today I learned something, so thank you for that information. Yeah.
When I was writing a lot of fiction, I learned the differences so that I could say, well, I've done short stories, and now I've hit novellas and so on. So that's how I learned that.
Wikipedia has this listed as a novel from 1999, so we are on the cusp of hitting the 2000s here, and it might take a turn for, I don't know if it'll be the better, but it's certainly going to take a turn in 2000.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is kind of this novel foreshadows that, because it's definitely a little different than, I mean, all King works are different than each other, of course. But this one, I mean, for the most part, you could give this to an 8-year-old and they could read it. Like, there's not a whole lot of there's not violence and gore, and there's some adult themes kind of, but it's very much a novel that's about a child and is written in that kind of mindset, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, this was actually one of the first King books that I can remember reading, and I don't know exactly which one came first, but this was one of the first 3 to 5, definitely. And I think it was because it was one of those shorter books, and I, you know, read what it was about, and it's like, oh, girl lost in the woods. Okay, this doesn't seem too terrifying or anything. And even though it is a terrifying situation, I think the way King wrote it was just, this is a thing that happened. Here's how it played out from mostly the girl's perspective. And you get this nice, quick story from him that really just feels so concise in comparison to some of his other works.
Oh yeah, it's a very tight story. And I love the conceit that he has of how it's not chapters, it's innings based on baseball.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was really good because it feels like you know that every inning is going to escalate, and you know this is going to be a shorter story because, you know, other than the 7th, like, baseball innings are only so long. So I love that it feels like he kind of gave himself a challenge in this to keep the story very tight. And he does a great job. It's every page is important, and all of it is, I think all of it is pretty interesting, how he lays out, you know, Trisha's life and how she experiences being lost and all of that stuff.
And even though there are little hints here and there of how late 90s this is, you know, she has a Walkman, and for anyone who isn't baseball inclined, I'm not a huge baseball fan, but I know enough about it. Tom Gordon was a pitcher for the Boston Red Sox from 96 to 99. And if I'm not mistaken, Stephen King is a pretty big Red Sox fan because that's sort of the team closest to him. And it seems like anyone who is from like Boston and more northeast of that is going to be a fan of Boston sports, pretty much.
Oh, is that kind of the rule of these things? I don't know anything about sports, so, or especially the culture.
I think that's what it tends to be. Like, people from Boston are super into Boston sports, and I think it kind of trickles out to like Maine, Rhode Island, because those states don't have big sports team. So I think it's kind of like the Celtics, the Red Sox, and the New England Patriots kind of just have that area nailed down for the most part as far as the fan base goes. I could be wrong, but I think that's the general gist that I get from people who are from those areas and like sports.
Okay, that makes sense. I agree. I think King is a pretty big Red Sox fan. And so there's quite a bit of baseball in this. I didn't remember because I read this book back, oh, probably around when it came out. And so I was more into baseball then. And now, as reading it now, and I was like, okay, I gotta pull that info out of the deep recesses of my memory so that I can make sense of what she's talking about when she's going into the more in-depth baseball stuff.
Yeah, because she tries listening to the game through her Walkman and tries to pick up a station. And that's part of what makes me think that Boston sports has sort of a stronghold in that area, because a radio station in Maine is broadcasting the Red Sox game.
Right. I thought that was weird. I was like, Maine is doing that? Like, that's, I wonder what that's about. So I'm glad now I know. Well, they don't have their own baseball team, so they kind of, everybody kind of goes on to the closest available one. And I know, aren't the Red Sox a pretty successful team in general? Or over the years, rather?
Yes. Historically, they have been pretty darn successful.
Okay.
And they have like this big rivalry with the Yankees. So it's like a whole big Northeastern rivalry thing, because the Yankees have always like paid the most money to their players and done all this crazy stuff over the years to get the best players.
Yes, I've heard about that. So, okay. And they mentioned it briefly about them, the Sox, playing the Yankees. And I was like, oh, yeah, there's, I think it feels like everybody has a rivalry with the Yankees. You know, we have the Twins here in Minnesota, and everybody's always very concerned when the Yankees come to play. But yeah, I think this is such an interesting novel. And I think I'm really interested to see, especially what this signals for his 2000s work, because this is, like I said, a much less violent or, I mean, it's definitely, there's some horror aspects to it, but like you said, it's really the situation that she's in of being lost in, you know, the deep, deep woods.
In Maine, where it gets either really hot or really cold, probably.
Yeah, and there's bears, and I'm sure there's wolves and like all kinds of animals that are dangerous to a 9-year-old. So she's kind of has to survive on her own. And I mean, she does a great job. Like, 9-year-old me probably wouldn't have done that good of a job.
Oh, yeah. Same. I was just like, oh, yeah, she's only 9. You're reading this. You're like, wait, maybe she's a teenager. And then you're like, nope, she most certainly is not. And there are some childish aspects throughout the story that kind of remind you of that. And you're just like, oh, right, this is a child we are reading about. And she's going through one of the worst things you can imagine. And then she's hearing on the radio that someone called in a tip that this random guy like took her. And you're just like, no, that's not what's happening. But then it distracts the authorities from finding her. And you see throughout it that, okay, the authorities are looking in this small area because they think a 9-year-old possibly couldn't have gone too far off the beaten path. And then we find out she's in a totally different area, like miles and miles away. And you're just like, oh, she just kept going and going and going like the little Energizer bunny.
Right? Exactly. It's like almost like her resourcefulness is a detriment to her at times. Because at that point you're like, no, honey, just stop, just stay. But at the same time, like, she'd kind of gone too far at that point. Like, if she'd stayed where she was initially, she would have been found easily. But because she decided to keep going, you understand the urge to do something and not just kind of sit there and wait, because that's so much anxiety and fear. And instead, you feel like you have to do something. And at the same time, she shouldn't have done anything.
But that works within the context of the story, because she is 9 years old, and you know that her brain obviously isn't fully developed to sort of work through all of these reasons why she shouldn't just try to meet them on the other side of, you know, this little section where she went off to go to the bathroom. And you're like, oh, okay, she just, you know, wants to try to get back and forgot which way she came. So, you know, she's going to just try and catch up with them somewhere else. That makes sense for a 9-year-old. And let's backtrack a little and dive into how this all started in the first place. She was going on this trip with her mom and her brother, and Pete, the brother, was constantly arguing with the mom over, you know, typical child versus parent things. And you get a sense that they are so engrossed in their arguments with each other that they're not even paying attention to where Trisha is, what she's doing, because she seems to be the less problematic child at that particular moment in time. And so she even tries to tell them she has to go to the bathroom, and none of them hear her. I can't really tell if they were in a big group or a small group, because you would think someone would have noticed, hey, this child just kind of wandered off the path and never rejoined. And when you're reading through, you're kind of like, okay, when are they going to notice she's gone? And it takes them a scary amount of time.
Yeah, it does. And so sad when, you know, you seeing it from Trisha's perspective and she's like, oh, they must have figured out I'm gone by now. And then it switches back to them and nope, they're still fighting. And it's like, how could you just, I mean, I understand I've had those kinds of situations before. It's easy to get distracted and, you know, you assume that your easier child and is following you and all of that. But it's just so painful to see, because you know Trisha is at this point scared and knows she's lost and nothing is going to happen for her until they notice that she's lost, that she's not with them anymore. I love that King goes back and forth between her and her parents and gives us just a little bit of their, and Pete, and their feelings about what's going on. Because then we kind of get the opposite of, we see what Trisha thinks is true, whether or not what Trisha thinks is true. Because you periodically hear about, she talks about her imagining what's happening while she's gone.
Yeah, you also get these glimpses that she has this sort of different relationship with her father, even though he's not there for the trip or anything like that. It's one of those things where you're kind of like, oh, okay, so baseball is the thing she has that she shares with her dad. And right now she's just sort of missing her entire family, because even though there are obviously various problems, it's one of those things where it's still your parents, still your brother, you're still going to care. And you really see that at the end when they are reunited and you're kind of like, oh, okay.
Right. And that's kind of a, you know, she has definitely a very complex relationship with her dad. He's an alcoholic and her parents have recently divorced, and she's, seems like she is trying to figure out how to adapt to this big change in her life. And that that definitely contributes to what she hallucinates and experiences in the woods. And that part is also, I think, done really well, of how he kind of threads through. She gets stung by the wasps, so she sees, you know, the creepy wasp priest, and the bear becomes the, what did they call him, the Lord of Nothing or the Lord of the Woods or something?
God of the Lost.
Thank you. Yes. And so all of these things are affecting her as she continues on her journey, and you can see the parallels between what she's experiencing in the woods versus what she's been experiencing at home.
Plus the way that he weaves all of the sports references in, you can tell he has a love for baseball, which I think a lot of people know about Stephen King because he literally wrote a Red Sox book with Peter Straub, if I'm not mistaken. And he has written about like Owen's Little League team, and some of these things have been collected in his short story collections. But with this, you really just get a sense of what sports can mean to at least certain people in a family, because there are some families that are big sports families, and you can just tell, like, when you walk up to their house, they have the flags out for their sports teams, and you see all of the sports stuff around the house. But with this, because we don't get a glimpse of the house, we have to get all of this information through Trisha while she's lost in the woods, and then she starts seeing Tom Gordon as well, and then you have that moment at the end with her and her dad where she asks for the Red Sox hat that is signed by Tom Gordon, and she points up to the sky like he does when he finishes off a game. And it just goes to show how much of an impact sports can have on kids, on families, and how much it can bring people together.
Right. And it's not overbearing. Like, as someone who doesn't you know, doesn't sport and doesn't have much to do with that. Like, it's
not a fan of the sports balls.
Yes, the sports balls. Nothing against them, just not for me. But I think even with all of that, like, it's still very affecting for me that it's happening. And I was able to relate to it without that kind of knowledge or experience.
Yeah, it's one of those stories of his where it's fun, but the topic matter is not fun at the same time. It's just like, this was one of those things that was really nice to read because it has a good ending, I think. It's not this horrible ending where people die and all of these things happen. It's one of his more uplifting stories almost, because you see that they catch this guy who is a criminal, and even though he didn't do anything to Trisha, he's still someone that the cops should have been made aware of anyway. And then she gets reunited with the family at the end, and it's not one of those things where, like, the dad isn't going to be in the room at the same time as the mom, even though they're divorced. It's like they're all there when she wakes up.
It's a hopeful ending, I think. And it's also such a powerful journey. Like, and that final confrontation she has with what she sees as, you know, she gathers all her courage and defies her fears manifested in, you know, this bear. And, you know, she survives. And that's such a, it's so rewarding in a King book when you get to see someone overcome with, I mean, she goes through a lot of difficult things, but it's not like, you know, as we always go back to, it's not like in It where the kids go through some horrifically traumatizing events. Like, this feels much more, yeah, like this is something that could happen to a kid and has, you know. This is like when I was in hiking in the Rocky Mountains, and I was on like the easiest trail, but they have signs all over the place, do not step off the trail under no circumstances. Yeah. Like, because if you go out there and you lose sight of it, like, it's, and you're not an experienced, like, forestry person, you get lost super easily. So,
and that's actually happened here in recent months. There was, to sidetrack a little bit, there was like this hidden treasure thing that people were looking for, and two guys kept going out on ATVs, and this was like during winter when it kept snowing heavily, and they got lost, and I think they were found the first time, and then they went out again, and then I think one of them died because they got lost a second time. And it's just like, you can't be doing those things in heavily wooded areas in the mountains where it's going to be very, very hard to find you.
Right. I mean, when we were at the park, like, they had one of the, someone was lost because they had a helicopter out doing the search thing.
Yeah.
It is such an easily doable thing for a kid or, you know, someone our age or whatever. It's totally an experience that anyone can have. And it's, the horror in it is very light. And it's pretty clear from the writing that it was, you know, if you've read a few Stephen King books, you can tell the difference, I think, between when the horror is being created by the person's mind in the book or when the horror is actually in the real world. You know, those are two very different types of horror. And this one is pretty clear that what's going on is the first, where her, you know, slowly traumatized brain, and she's getting sicker and sicker, and she starts hallucinating. And it's, I think it's no less horrific for being something like that.
Yeah, and there's no real supernatural element to it because everything that she sees can be explained by her hallucinations, which are a very real thing. And one thing I wanted to ask you about this, do you feel like this is almost like one of the better gateway King novels to get people into his work, maybe if they're not super into the idea of horror?
Yes, totally. I think because, like I said, I read it when it came out, and I'd read a few Stephen King books before then. I think The Shining was my first, which I think is also a good gateway. But this one is totally for someone who, like you said, not very into horror books. It's like, well, there's still plenty of Stephen King for you. And he's still a writer that's worth reading, even if you're not into horror. And this one is a good example of how wide-ranging he can be and how he can tell these little fascinating stories as well as, you know, these big, huge epics. Like, you know, the Dark Tower or something. And, you know, because after this one, you could give them the Green Mile. And that would be a, you know, that one actually does have some supernatural elements, but not too much. So it's a nice gateway, I think.
Yeah, and because this and the Green Mile were two of my first King reads, it didn't even dawn on me until we were sitting here discussing it. I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe this is one of those things that can get people into King without being too overbearing. It's like you don't want to hand someone nope. it the first time they're going to read King, because that's like 1,200 pages. And I know there are some people who only read the Dark Tower series, like Becky, who has been on to discuss some of the books with me so far. And she's not big on horror either. So I was kind of running through my head like, okay, what could I convince her to read that wouldn't be something on the scale of It and not be too terribly horror driven? Right. And this is definitely one of those things that I think you can suggest to a lot of people, because it is a horrific story, but it's an everyday thing. Not necessarily every day, but people get lost in the woods fairly frequently, given how many woods there are across the United States and even around the world.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other, yeah, you definitely wouldn't want to give someone who's not into horror something like Desperation. Here, brutality. Or, you know,
yeah,
even necessarily Gerald's Game, although that is another one of his books that doesn't necessarily have any supernatural elements. That one's a bit more vague about what is happening.
Just the hand scene alone in that, though, is reason enough to not give it to someone as one of their first King reads.
Yeah, or you know what else would be good is Dolores Claiborne. I think that would be a good one, because it does have a little bit of violence and brutality in it, but really the story is more about this woman's life and how she survives and takes care of her child. Yeah, I think this book is it's a good introduction because it's so relatable. Like you said, people get lost in the woods every day. And, you know, some people get lost for 5 minutes and some people get lost and never come back and everything in between. And so if you've ever gone hiking or thought about going hiking, that's an idea that's probably occurred to you of getting lost in the woods and how scary that would be.
Yeah, and especially just since I've been in Colorado, you see all these news stories about people going missing and just never coming back. And I'm just like, this is wild. Because obviously where I was in California, there weren't a ton of woods. There are obviously woods in California, but in Orange County, it's few and far between for places where you can truly get lost. And I was just kind of like, oh, this is a thing that probably happens more frequently here because of the woods and the mountains and just all of this different terrain that I'm not necessarily used to. And given that, you know, a few months now we've been in quarantine, nobody's really going out hiking anywhere. I don't know if any of the like state parks or anything are still open. They might be now, but I feel like this is just one of those stories that can really hit home depending on where you live, if you've gone hiking, like you said, and just things like that. And Stephen King is so, so good at giving us these real stories. And while he does usually put this supernatural element in the stories as well, with this, he didn't do that. So you're just like, oh, okay, he just took a break from that and gave us this story where there's not really a whole lot going on outside of just what this girl is going through.
Right. And that we get that in pretty great detail. And that's also, I think, why it's so affecting, because it's nothing that happens to her physically is really something that you haven't experienced. You know, she gets sick, she is anxious and fearful and worried. And so all of those things are relatable. Like, no, she's not going through a supernatural event, so we can all understand how she must feel at that moment. And so it can grab anybody as a reader instead of people who are more open to the fantastic, which horror is fantastic because it's outside of our reality. It's something that I remember the first time I read it, I remember really, really liking it and having it be one of my favorite King books. And I think this time rereading it, I think that's definitely a decision or a opinion that holds up, because it's, and especially now reading even more King than I've ever read before, it's even more obvious to me how different it is and how well written it is, and how much I like it was improved by all of that King experience.
Yeah, I want to go back to when you mentioned that she was super resourceful, almost to her detriment at times, or definitely to her detriment at times. Do you think that's because she grew up in a place like Maine, where, yes, they have cities, but they're still not on the scale of where you are in Minneapolis or even just the Orange County, Los Angeles area where I grew up? And I feel like it's just a whole different way of learning, almost, not necessarily in school, but just how people live their lives in Maine versus somewhere like California. There's just this sense that almost everyone in Maine seems resourceful in some way.
Yes. Yes. I think that is, it's a different way of life. I think when you're living, you know, Maine is a pretty difficult place to live in regards to the weather. Like, if you, without modern conveniences, Maine was a pretty challenging place to settle and make more habitable for humanity. So, and most of the upper northeast, or yes, northeast part of the U.S., that's the impression of their culture there, you know, because we kind of have little pockets of culture all over the U.S. and they all differ a little bit. And that's, you know, I grew up in the suburbs of the Twin Cities, and there's a little bit of that, you know, because out where I was living, there's quite a few like park reserves. And so I learned about some of that stuff. But the way that Trisha describes, like, going to school and her mom teaching her all of this, it seems much more common that they impart that information to children, because what she, you know, her getting lost, it's such a constant thing that could happen to you. Like, it's a realistic thing that could happen to anyone, in the same way that, you know, here in the Midwest, we prepare for tornadoes. Everyone knows what to do when a tornado comes, and everyone knows the signs of a tornado. And we're taught from, you know, infancy, you know, go downstairs, get your radio, bring your water, all of that stuff. And here it seems much more like, okay, well, if you're lost in the woods, these are the things you can eat. You know, this is what you do. This is how you handle that, because they know that that's a real risk in their environment.
Were you ever worried that Trisha was going to eat the wrong thing and the whole story was just going to take a turn for the worse? Even though I had read this one before, I read it so long ago that I couldn't remember all of the details. I had the gist of the story, but I had no recollection of how it ended. So every time she would eat something, I was like, oh no, oh no, oh no.
Yes, I did have that too, because I had the same experience of like, I remember some things go really bad at the end. I don't remember how. And but for the most part, like, she makes some pretty great decisions. And I love that King acknowledges that in the book, that, you know, this choice was the bad choice. When she takes the turn and decides to go north, that's, you know, the worst decision she makes throughout this whole journey, other than to keep going away from the path initially. It was totally freaky when she eats those berries. I was like, are those the same berries her and her mom talked about, or are they different berries?
Yeah.
And I felt that way throughout the whole book, like even up to the end, like when she finds the truck and before, like, which is right before, you know, or pretty close to before the final confrontation and the end where she gets out. It's like every choice feels very fraught with danger and how she's going to handle it. Like, or especially when she eats the fish. I was like, you don't eat raw fish. Yeah. You don't eat raw river fish. That's another thing we're taught here, is you don't eat raw river fish. You don't eat raw lake fish. Like, make you sick. So when she does that, I was like, oh God. Oh God.
Yeah. Sushi has always baffled me, and I'm not a fish person to begin with, or like a seafood person at all. I'll eat shrimp and that's about it. But even then, I'm just like, I don't really want any of this.
I love seafood. And I grew up eating fishing and eating lake trout and eating all kinds of different fish. And I've eaten lots and lots of sushi. But yeah, it's like river fish are more likely to have lots of bad bacteria for you. So you definitely don't want to eat it raw. But I mean,
I'm guessing that's because they haven't been like cleaned properly and all of that fun stuff.
Yes. And I think there's more heavy pollutants in a bigger concentration and something like that.
Okay.
Whereas ocean fish, I think it's also something about the makeup of the different fish. But I think it is also, you get that sense of relief every time she eats something and it stays down and she doesn't have a bad reaction to it. It's like, oh,
yeah,
this one was okay. Now I hope it stays that way.
Yeah, well, I know this episode isn't going to be quite as long as some of our others simply because this is one of his shorter stories, but I just want to wrap this up with saying that I really enjoyed how he takes Trisha through this journey because it's not always easy. There are some things that are easier than others. There are some things that she struggles with a lot more than others. And it's just sort of this up and down roller coaster ride that you're going on with this 9-year-old. And because she's a child, even younger than all of the kids in It, if I'm not mistaken, aside from Georgie. And you just don't want anything bad to ever happen to children, even though Stephen King has written bad things happening to children.
So much. Oh, my God. And I think that it's a great writing of a child, which, I mean, we've talked about that before, about how good he is at writing from different perspectives and all of that. But since this one is so more set in the real world, I think his writing of a 9-year-old, having had a 9-year-old fairly recently, is pretty spot on how she reacts and what she does. Like, she's like we've talked about, she's very resourceful, but it's not out of the realm of what a 9-year-old could do. Like, my son could definitely, if he had known those things, I wouldn't have been surprised by him having those, by taking those actions. And her thought processes and how she's handling all of this feels very accurate to a 9-year-old. And I think that's also a big part of why the story succeeds, because all of it feels realistic. You know, she's not a Mary Sue. She's not for all of the negative and complicated connotations that has, still, she's so likable. I think that's the other thing, is I think Trisha is very likable as a character and very relatable.
Yeah, I actually ended up bumping up my rating when I reread this. I, for whatever reason, only had it at a 3 out of 5 the first time I read it, but maybe that's because I was young and didn't read too much into what I was reading. So right. I bumped this up to a 4 out of 5. And I know you said it's one of the top King books for you after having reread it. So what would your rating be for it?
Do we do half stars? I never
You can
remember.
Do half stars.
I'd say 4.5 out of 5, honestly. Like, this is one, like, I think I'll probably read it again, like, regularly. Like, every few years, I could see myself reading this. Like, oh, I'm in the mood for a little Stephen King. This is the perfect little dip in and out. And I get all of the things I really like about King without having to spend, you know, a few weeks reading it. Like, I listen to the audiobook on this, like I always do, which is read by Anne Heche. And it's really, really good. It's 6 hours. So it's
bite-sized King.
Yeah, exactly. But it's still full King. Like, you still get the great character development and the complex story and the twisting narrative. You still get all those great things, but you can take it, and it's a hopeful story. So even if you're, you know, it's the dead of winter and you're feeling the sad and all of that, you can still read this and have a little bit of that horror element without feeling like totally crushed at the end of it or at any point throughout the book. You feel anxiety for her, but you're never going to be like, it's never going to punch you in the gut like some of Stephen King's stuff does.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I want to give it a better rating, because a really high rating, because I think it's such a great example and so readable for so many reasons.
Exactly. And because of its length, it's one you can revisit very easily. And I think, you know, with everything that I have coming up, there's nothing short again until The Colorado Kid. So I have a stretch of probably about 10 books that are pretty lengthy, maybe not by King standards.
Yep, and we're doing The Plant soon, which is not short, not super long, but not short.
Yeah, I skipped ahead, so I have to start that too.
Oh, God.
But Katie, thank you so much for coming on to talk about The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon today. If you've listened this far and for some reason haven't read it, I highly recommend doing that, because even though we told you what happened, there's still so much to pull out of it detail-wise that we didn't dive into. And I think it's just one of those quick King reads that you can knock out in a day or two or three, depending on how fast you read.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. If you haven't read this, give it a read, because knowing what happens does not spoil the story. It's very much one of King's books that it's the details that make it so good. Like the experience that you have going through it with Trisha, that's why this book is so great.
Exactly. Well, Katie, I know you will be back on soon, so I'm sure we will have another fun discussion in the works in the coming weeks.
Yes, and I'm as always, I'm excited, and thank you for having me on.
Of course. All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.